Today at Reader's Corner, Heidi Reeder, author of Commit to Win, How to Harness the Four Elements of Commitment to Reach Your Goals.
At its core, it's a cost-reward analysis. How much do I really treasure this activity, this job, this relationship, versus how much trouble does it cause me? One of the things that really takes away from our commitment is distractions, is having a bunch of other options for things to do. And the way that most people think of overcommitted is I have too many obligations. I'm talking about if you're so dedicated to something, you are so attached to sticking with it, even though it's no longer working. When we invest ourselves in something, when we've put our creativity and our own hands into it, we value it a lot more, and we're going to stick with it a lot longer.
I'm Bob Kustra, president of Boise State University. Welcome to Reader's Corner. Businesses seeking to increase productivity, athletes striving to improve their performance, and couples intent on strengthening their relationship share this in common. To get what they're after, they'll need more than motivation. They'll need commitment. Today's guest, Heidi Reeder, is an expert on how commitment enables organizations and individuals to reach their goals. Her new book, Commit to Win, unpacks 40 years of research by psychologists and economists to bust the many myths about commitment and explain why it's important. A recent review in The Economist magazine described Commitment to Win as, and I'm quoting here, packed with intelligence and clarity of both thought and expression, learned yet eminently accessible. It is a rare pleasure. High praise indeed for Dr. Reeder's book. I'm pleased to welcome Heidi Reeder to our program today. She is an associate professor of communication at Boise State University and was the Carnegie Foundation Idaho Professor of the Year in 2007. Dr. Reeder blogs for Psychology Today and has been featured on The Today Show and on Life and Style. She has authored articles for leading communication and social psychology journals and provides keynotes and workshops for many professional organizations. Dr. Reeder joins us today in the studio for the interview. Heidi Reeder, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Thank you so much. Great to be here.
Hey, congratulations on that Economist quote. That's
Thank
a big
you.
Deal.
Yes, it was really great to read that.
Wow. Now, I assume that you have a publisher that is very interested in making sure things like that get out. So they're contacting everybody, but it's like throwing stuff at the wall. You never know what's going to stick.
Absolutely. They send copies of books to every magazine and blogger they can think of. And those people get stacks of books, as I'm sure you do here. And
right.
You get lucky if somebody reads it and in this case really likes it.
Well, and it's not just that it was in The Economist. It's what they said. I mean, it's really high praise for your work. And let's talk about that. So how do you define commitment?
Well, you know, I think there's a lot of misnomers about commitment. Some people hear the word commitment and they instantly think obligation. And it's almost like, oh man, that's a downer because we don't really like the feeling that comes with obligation.
Right.
So I define it in the way that social scientists and social psychologists define it, which is actually a psychological attachment to something and the intent to stick with it. So it doesn't come from the outside. It's not like an obligation that someone else is asking me to do. It's what do I really feel attached to continuing? And I think that's really different than having to willpower myself into something or force myself into something to find that internal dedication.
You know, I was thinking about the examples we used in your introduction, whether it's somebody who is working in an organization, an employee who's seeking some kind of renewed commitment for what he or she does, and we're going to talk about that in a moment. But I also thought of our own students, and you, of
yeah.
course, have written a book here that is not really aimed or directed necessarily at students. It's a general purpose book. But not too long ago, Diane Dean and Arthur Levine, Arthur Levine's with the Columbia Teachers College and Diane Dean's with Illinois State University, they wrote a book called Generation on a Tightrope. And it's a description of today's college student. And among the many conclusions they reached, and by the way, this was a very extensive national survey of undergraduate students at all kinds of universities. So from the small community college or liberal arts college to the large public or private research university, they were all in there. And one of the things they concluded, and I'm really going to roughly paraphrase this, and I hope I don't get them wrong, but they said our students are more connected than ever, and yet they're disconnected.
Mm.
Obviously, they're referring to being connected in the digital sense, because you see them the minute they walk into your classroom, the minute they leave their classroom, they flip out those smartphones. I see them walking up and down the quad all the time. And yet what Diane Dean and Arthur Levine are saying is that the survey showed that collectively, as groups of students, for example, who are forming friendships and sharing bonds. It's not like it was in previous generations. And I wonder, again, this is a book about commitment. Do you see any difference in students in just recent years with so much mobile technology surrounding them, with it being so easy to escape the personal relationship? Yeah. The commitment, one might argue. Yeah. Do you see any change in these students from earlier years?
Yeah, and I really agree with the premise here, and it's supported by some of this research that says one of the things that really takes away from our commitment is distractions, is having a bunch of other options for things to do. You know, back when I was in school, there was a textbook and there was class and there was hanging out with people after class and a job. You know, those were really my only choices. Today's students have so many choices. I could be on Facebook. I could be reading a blog. I could be doing all these other things, connecting with people through Twitter, instead of really committing to this moment and learning in this classroom. And so, you know, I don't know if I've noticed, you know, any particular outcomes in my classes, because we turn off those electronic devices.
That's
we get rid of those distractions. It is a rule.
Right.
We get rid of those distractions because, you know, as I'm sure you know, those do reduce learning. When they test students afterwards, some of them were allowed to have digital devices and others weren't. Their learning goes down. So if I want to be really committed to my education, one of the things I can do for myself is get rid of other choices, get rid of those distractions, commit, first of all, to turning those things off and really focusing on the goal in front of me.
You identify some myths in your book, myths about commitment, one of which I thought was very interesting, and it surprised me a little bit, that apparently there's such a thing as being overcommitted, and that's not necessarily good. I mean, we think of commitment as whole hog, man, I'm giving it all I have. And you're saying, well, you can get overcommitted.
Yeah. So the way that most people think of overcommitted is I have too many obligations. I'm talking about if you're so dedicated to something, you are so attached to sticking with it, even though it's no longer working. So I think we have this mythology around commitment that says the more the better. The more committed I am to this job, the more committed I am to this goal, the more committed I am to my new product line, the better. But what if the market or just social relationships are giving me the feedback, this isn't working? Am I willing to take in that information and take the steps to what I call decommitting? You know, decommitting is an important process too. And there are steps that you can take to help yourself let go.
So is decommit the next book?
That's right. Commit to win and now decommit to win.
Okay.
Well, that's part of it, right? If you want to win in one area, you've got to decommit from another area.
Right.
And in the writing of this book, people ask me, how were you able to do this in such a short period of time? Well, I decommitted from everything else, right? I used to do theater. I stopped doing that. I used to play tennis. I stopped doing that. That was hard to do. But for that period of time, that was what was essential to reach my goal.
And that goal was reached in 9 months?
Yeah, probably like 10, but
10
months. Once from contract to full book submitted was a short time period, and that included a lot of the research for the book too.
Well, you also were on sabbatical, and for those of our listeners who understand anything about sabbaticals, I'm sure to some it's a mystery. Like, why do you let these people off? I mean, you mean they're not going to have to do anything?
Right.
You're living proof that, you can really do something on sabbatical.
Absolutely. I didn't even know. So this is a popular book. A lot of academics write academic books, scholarly books intended for a scholarly audience. And that was my training, you know, as well, going through graduate school. So during the sabbatical, I had to figure out, you know, how do you write for a public audience? How do you write a book proposal? How do you write a pitch? You know, these are things that professors aren't usually taught.
And so this was a first for you then, this public audience approach.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Yeah.
And so so I had a one semester sabbatical, which is the equivalent of about 3 months. And so I spent that time designing the book, figuring out what the book would be about, how to write it, how to pitch it. And then was fortunate enough right at the end of the sabbatical to get a publisher to give a contract and sign me on and said, now please do it ASAP.
You're listening to Heidi Reeder. She is the author of Commit to Win, How to Harness the Four Elements of Commitment to Reach Your Goals. So let's talk about how this book would be helpful for an employer in an organization, a way of assuring a stable employee pool, reduce turnover. And I suspect there are employers who are going to read your book and give you a ring and say, hey, Heidi, can you come talk to us? This is an area where we've got a problem with turnover, and it obviously is related to commitment. You cite a Gallup poll in your book about this issue of low percentage of workers really committed to their jobs. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so this was a Gallup poll. It was actually a global Gallup poll. So we're talking about the workforce across our planet. And what they found in terms of a level of commitment and how really invested people are in the job that they go to every day, a surprising 13% identified themselves as truly psychologically committed to their job at a high level. And so 13% of us go to work and we're really dedicated, we're all in, we're being proactive, we're looking for ways to make this job really meaningful and an important part of our lives. Another percentage, I'm probably going to get these percentages a little bit off, it was around 20-something percent of the people are not just checked out, but they're actively working against the goals of the organization. I think we can all look around our organization, maybe identify that one guy, right? But the majority, which was around 63%, again, these might not add up, sorry, but it was in the 60s. The majority of people, they just would show up. They'd kind of sleepwalk through their job. They said, I'm not really that committed. I'm not against the organization, but I'm just kind of there and doing the minimum amount to get by. And certainly from the perspective of people who run companies, you know, or nonprofits or any kind of organization, right. That's right. Potentially problematic, right? You want that 13% to grow.
So this problem of commitment, is this genetic? Is this learned? Can you reverse it? And that's why I would assume you can reverse it. And I assume that's why you could make quite a bit of money as a consultant running around the country talking to companies about this issue.
Yeah, actually, just yesterday, I gave a keynote to an organization, just an hour-long thing, and they immediately turned around and said, you know, we'd love to have you come in and talk specifically to our leadership team. Yeah. Because I was talking with them specifically about some of the factors that help people feel committed, and especially in the context of an organization. And we often go to, well, it's got to be money, right? But we can't pay them any more money. We can't give them any more special bennies. So forget it. There's no way we can make them more committed. But really, it's those intrinsic rewards of feeling like I'm doing a really valuable service at my job, that whatever seemingly menial task I'm doing actually has greater meaning and greater purpose. And if we can help people see their work in that larger context, it can make a real difference that they're coming to work with a sense of fulfillment and meaning.
You also came to an interesting conclusion from surveying the research, I guess, about the reward structure and how you give out rewards. And I believe it was something about spontaneity. And you don't necessarily have to say, okay, every Friday at noon we're announcing who the really good guys are and right. who the bad ones are.
Right. And this goes back, you know, into that old psychology research with the rats, and, you know, you give them the random reward structure, right? And the rats that are randomly rewarded, if people can remember back to their Psych 101 class, they were more motivated to try to stick by that button and push it and get that, you know, little treat than the ones that were coming on a schedule. Now, does this apply to people? Well, it looks like it does. Those rewards that come to us when we're not expecting them seem to be infused with such greater meaning than the ones that we've come to count on. And this can be a downside, obviously, because we can start to take things for granted. And so what I suggest to people, whether it's in a relationship or in the workforce, is even if the rewards aren't coming at random, really appreciate, like, each time you get that paycheck, each time you get that compliment, even if you were expecting it, like, really take that in and your job will be more rewarding.
So you point out that commitment theory is rooted in part in economics. How's that work?
So it really goes back to your basic cost reward. I mean, at least part of – in the book, I share an equation that's based on a large body of literature, that four factors that predict commitment. And the very first two factors, I call them treasures and troubles. How much do I really treasure this activity, this job, this relationship versus how much trouble does it cause me? Well, what is that? At its core, it's a cost-reward analysis, right? Mm-hmm. And so that was originally from economics. And I know people take these things for granted, but there was a time where we didn't even consider that buyers were thinking, okay, how much does this cost me relative to how much do I get? I mean, at one point, that was a novel conclusion for early economists to come up with. And it turned out that that same kind of exchange that we make with the marketplace really occurs when we exchange with people, whether it's people in the workforce or people in our social circles. We're making that cost-reward exchange with them as well. And if it's a positive outcome, we want to stick with it.
So one factor that impacts job performance is whether workers feel they are being justly rewarded. And you touched on this before, but there's an insurance firm example that you use in your book that I thought was very telling.
Yeah, some researchers are incredibly creative. And the researchers in this case, they had an in with this insurance company, and the insurance company was going through some changes updating its building and updating the office space. And so they said, hey, while you're doing that, would you mind if we did a little experiment? Let's randomly assign people who are different levels in this organization, let's randomly assign them to office space so that, you know, the top dog might end up in a small little windowless office without a door, right? And some newbie who's just learning the ropes, who everybody else has to help even get through the 9-to-5, might end up with the mahogany desk and the floor-to-ceiling window. And they tested, how did this affect motivation? How did this affect people's sense of satisfaction in the workplace? And the interesting thing, one of the really interesting things, they found some of the things you might expect, first of all. But one of the other interesting things they found was when people got too much, the guy that got the too good office, he actually felt less satisfied, which I think is really interesting. It says that he must
nothing
have felt guilty.
Thank you for reminding
me of that. Yeah, he felt less satisfied, which led him to want to strive and do better in order to earn these benefits that he was achieving, which tells us that we do have this real inherent sense of things need to be equitable. Things need to be fair. We should be getting out what we're putting in.
So unique rewards can also influence commitment. How does Ben & Jerry's ice cream use this concept to increase employee loyalty?
Yeah, so there are several companies. Ben & Jerry's is one of them. Starbucks, I'm sure many more that I'm not familiar with. That they come up with a niche that they can communicate to their employees that makes working there a really valuable experience. So one of the things Ben & Jerry's has done is they've done a lot that is supportive of environmental efforts. So they're coming up with freezers, for example, that don't use as much energy, or they're taking some of their products from, you know, sustainable farms and doing a really good job of communicating what they're doing to their employees so that when employees work somewhere like that, it adds to that internal reward that they feel, that I'm part of something really great and really important. But then the other thing they do is that if you work at Ben & Jerry's, when you go home for the day, you are welcome to take a pint of ice cream with you. And so you're also just rewarded on a very superficial level there as well.
So research studies show that all of these positive experiences you talk about are one thing, but you tell us that negative experiences have an even greater impact. Help us understand what that's all about.
Yeah, so there's been really consistent research here that says that the negative experiences that we have as we're working toward a commitment impact us negatively to about 5 times the strength of a positive experience. And this was, I don't want to say originally, but at least formally originally discovered by a researcher originally from the University of Washington, Dr. John Gottman, who found that when couples are interacting, those couples that are more likely to last and be sustainable, they have 5 times as many positive interactions to every 1 negative. And the theory here is that the 1 negative impacts us so much more than the positive that we have to have 5 times as much positive to make up for it. They found the same equation in one study where they looked at people in the workplace and they had them report on, you know, positive things that happened in the workplace and negative, and then how good or how bad did they feel afterward. The negative things impacted their mood negatively 5 times as much as the positive. So, you know, we have two approaches if we're trying to make the workplace a better situation for people. One is any 1 negative that you can get rid of, any 1 bad apple, any 1 failing policy could have a massive impact. But if you can't do that, then you want to add about 5 times as much positive support, good feedback, just get that equation in balance.
Today we're talking about Commit to Win, how to harness the 4 elements of commitment to reach your goals. The author and our guest is Heidi Reeder, an associate professor of communications at Boise State University. An important caveat to this power of negativity deals with how the situation is remembered.
This is really, really interesting research. There's one really good thing about if we're having a series of setbacks, let's say we're working toward a goal, we're having a series of setbacks. If it ends positively, our minds do a wonderful thing, and that is we tend to remember the good because we have that, you know, however it ends is the way that we remember it. And so I use the example of somebody training for a marathon. If it's just painful and difficult and strained muscles and exhaustion and having to eat in a certain way, but then they finish that marathon strong, they're probably going to remember the joy of fulfilling the goal and not all the trouble and difficulty that occurred along the way. So it might be helpful as you're working toward a goal to remember that. Mm-hmm.
So how do organizations deal with that? How do they tap into this issue or this experience of the happy ending or what have you? How's that going
to
happen?
I think a really good thing to do would be, you know, to have a celebration of some kind. After a really difficult time, after someone has done a lot of effort, if they're celebrated for that afterward, then that's what they'll remember probably more than, you know, the team conflict or whatever that happened along the way.
I'm reading a book by the guy who founded Pixar. It's called Creativity Inc. And one of the things they did was create a note-taking day where the entire company shut down. And all they did is focus on the team, on the employees. And it was all about encouraging them to help the leadership team come up with ideas for the next adventure, for the next movie, for the next cartoon. I mean, whatever it is that they're – obviously Pixar makes a lot of movies, animated especially. And so is – I suppose that would be an example of how you actually get an organization moving.
Both sides are really benefiting because the organizational leaders at Pixar are getting some great ideas. The people that are coming up with the ideas are feeling valued for their contribution, and they're getting to end their week or their day – with a sense of, you know, creativity and moving forward and innovation. I'm just off the side of my head, I'm thinking about some of those maybe smaller businesses where maybe at the end of the day on Friday, you know, they have a little party or something to celebrate the end of the week. You know, it sends people into the weekend feeling good, more likely to come back refreshed on Monday.
You comment on spelling bees in relation to the Gottman research, positive and negative. I mean, I'm fascinated by these spelling bees, but you put a whole new angle on it.
Yeah, and this is from a really great body of research on grit. So grit is a concept that's associated with commitment, because if there's going to be troubles, as I mentioned, along the way, working toward a commitment, then sometimes I just got to use grit to get through it. And what they found, and these are among kids, you know, who are doing a spelling bee, right? What they found was that kids studying for that bee and putting hours into studying did just as well or better as the people who had a naturally high verbal IQ. Now, we tend to think, well, you're just lucky. You know, you had a high verbal IQ. Of course, you won the spelling bee. But the kids who gritted it out that maybe weren't as, like, technically starting at the same, you know, intellectual spot, they could grit it out and they could do just as well or better. And that applies not just to kids in spelling bees, but I think to all of us.
Mm-hmm. So what does the research tell us about ways to get people to increase their investment in an enterprise or an organization?
Yeah, a big part of commitment is investing and making contributions. We tend to think that if I'm committed, then I'll invest in something. You know, then I'll contribute to it. The research really finds that the other is actually quite true, that if I start contributing to something, if I invest in it, then I will actually become more committed as an outcome. So to me, that's really important when we think about goals or we think about wanting to be having people be committed to the organization. Get them to contribute. If you just tell people what to do, they're not going to be nearly as committed to it as if they contributed to the process. That's not just a nice saying. There's piles and piles of research that support that.
And you actually applied this to your own situation at the university regarding a student, I believe, who trying to motivate.
Yes. I was trying to motivate this student. He was a graduate. He was a graduate student, and he was struggling to get professors to sign on to be his thesis advisor and to be on his thesis team. And of course, a thesis is the big project that master's students do to get their degree. So it's really essential that he puts together a good team. But his strategy had been to just walk into the office and say, would you be on my committee? And, you know, professors are, you know, as you know, very busy. And so they've got to have a good reason to want to, you know, commit to working with you on the project. So I said, try a different angle. Instead of going in there and saying, will you do this for me? Go in there and say, hey, you know what? This is what my project is. Would you give me some suggestions? What authors would you look into? What researchers would you look into? What other professors would you suggest I talk to? Then the next time you meet with them, say, you know, I really appreciated your advice and counsel and all you gave me. Would you consider being on my... Now that they've already invested in you, the research shows there's a statistically increased likelihood that they'll say yes to the bigger request once they've said yes to the smaller request.
Mm-hmm. So what's the IKEA effect?
The IKEA effect. Now, everybody knows IKEA has this, you know, really good furniture for a very good price. Is that why people keep going back to IKEA? Well, some researchers wanted to look into whether it was actually people investing in the building of their own furniture that made them so dedicated to IKEA and to value the IKEA products so much, you know, more than they are really valued. So the study they did was they had subjects or participants come into the lab. They were randomly assigned to either the build it group or the inspect it group. Now, if you're in the build it group, you get the materials to build this IKEA product, right? And in this case, it was a black box, like a storage box. If you're in the inspect it group, you don't get to build it. You just, hey, there's a box, check it out, right? Now, when they were done building in the build it group, they said, how much do you think this box is worth? You know, give it a dollar amount. How much do you think we should sell this for? And then they did the same thing with the inspect it group. And the difference was, I think it was 63%. People valued the box that they built 63% at a higher value than the folks that just inspected it. And then they did it with origami. So they had people build the like little cranes or little whatever you do with the origami, right? And the people who built the origami versus just looked at pre-built origami valued it at 460% higher. Clearly, when we invest ourselves in something, when we've put our sweat equity in it, into it, when we've put, you know, our creativity and our own hands into it, we value it a lot more and we're going to stick with it a lot longer.
Boy, that sounds like a perfect justification for flipping the lecture, as we now call it in higher education.
Nice connection, yeah.
Where you really are saying to the student,
yeah,
look, you're going to learn, but I'm not going to sit up here and give you a 50-minute lecture. I want you to engage in this learning process.
Yes.
And you're going to do that in any number of ways. I mean, you must experiment with that in your own classes.
Yes, that is such a great connection, because if I'm just listening to a lecture, I haven't really invested anything other than 50 minutes of my time.
Yeah.
But if I'm doing projects, if I'm building something in the classroom, yes, if I'm working with my peers and I'm investing my energy, my mind, my creativity, my effort, then whatever I come up with, I'm going to take a greater sense of ownership for that. And ideally, we'd see them stick with it through the long haul, put more effort over time into that course and into their degree.
Mm-hmm. How much success do you think we're having in higher education, or you just talk about Boise State, in getting faculty to get away from? It's tough getting away from lecture notes, mm-hmm, because it's easy. I mean, lecture notes, I think, are... I taught for 28 years, and there was nothing more comfortable than walking into a class with a set of lecture notes that I had given for the last 5 years.
Right.
So I'm just going to give it again and add a few updates in terms of what's happened in the marketplace or in the world that's different. Getting faculty to focus in the meantime on something entirely different and tossing the classroom experience upside down, that's tough.
Yeah, and I think one of the things it really takes is some training, right? Because if we think about the factors that predict commitment, what would make me committed to changing my classroom structure? Well, it's got to be more easy than it is hard, right? And if I don't know how to do it, that's a lot of trouble for me, right?
Right, yeah.
So if we can find a way to make it easier, and I think our Center for Teaching and Learning is absolutely fabulous, a great resource. I've seen so many people get value out of that. Make it easy. Sign up for a workshop. Go over. Do this. See that in the long run, it might actually be easier for you as a professor. You're not straining your voice, right? Instead, you're just
exactly.
You're being a coach, right?
Well, that was a perfect way to end a half an hour conversation on teaching and learning, which is what you and I are all about.
Yes.
But again, congratulations on the book, Heidi.
Thank you very much.
The book is Commit to Win, How to Harness the Four Elements of Commitment to Reach Your Goals, and it's by Heidi Reeder, an associate professor of communications here at Boise State University. Next week, Christine Bader, author of The Evolution of a Corporate Idealist, When Girl Meets Oil. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones, research and production by Janelle Brown. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.